This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program tonight is co-sponsored by the Business and Leadership member-led forum, Kevin O'Malley, chair. Our program tonight is the San Francisco Green Film Festival. And I welcome Rachel Kaplan, CEO of the San Francisco Green Film Festival, who will introduce our speakers. Rachel?
Thanks, Anne. It's wonderful to be back at the club. So our program tonight is Wild Tales, Filmmaking and Conservation. Films can make us cry, can make us laugh out loud, and keep us thinking for days. But from Blackfish to Racing Extinction, filmmakers are capturing the power people have to make significant change and to protect our environments and wildlife. Tonight, I'm delighted to be joined by two leading Bay Area wildlife filmmakers. We're going to have a discussion about the role of filmmaking to save species and habitats. We're also excited tonight that we launch our 2016 festival season and our theme for this year, Keep It Wild, bringing you films that celebrate the characters that are taking on fierce battles and beautiful adventures to protect their bit of wild and prove the outdoors is for everyone. So to see more films, meet more filmmakers, and find out how you can keep it wild, please join me at the 2016 Green Film Festival, April 14 to 20th, with 70 new films at the Castro Theatre, Roxy Theatre, and venues across San Francisco and Berkeley. Tonight for our event, Wild Tales, Filmmaking and Conservation, I'd like to introduce our two guests with reading you their short biographies. Judy Irving, to my right here, is a Sundance and Emmy Award-winning filmmaker whose theatrical credits include The Wild Parrots of Telegraph Hill, a feature documentary about the relationship between a homeless street musician and a flock of wild parrots in San Francisco. Also, Pelican Dreams, about California brown pelicans and the people who know them best. And Dark Circle, a personal film about the links between nuclear power and weapons. Wild Parrots was a top 10 film of the year in the National Film Critics Poll, the highest rated program on National PBS series Independent Lens that year, and is now in international distribution. Pelican Dreams, completed in late 2014, features a young brown pelican who mistakenly landed tired, hungry, and confused on the roadway of the Golden Gate Bridge, and created a spectacular traffic jam and reignited Judy's years-long fascination with these ancient, charismatic birds. Judy received a master's in film and broadcasting from Stanford University and a Guggenheim Fellowship in film. Welcome, Judy.
Thank you.
To have you here.
Thank you.
Thanks. Also joining us, I'm delighted to introduce David McGuire, a marine biologist and ocean advocate. David is the founder of the ocean health and shark conservation nonprofit Shark Stewards. As a research associate of the Department of Aquatic Biology at the California Academy of Sciences, David is conducting a shark research program that includes population studies, movements, and fisheries impacts. As a captain, dive master, and filmmaker, David has explored the world ocean on numerous sailing voyages, producing media with an emphasis on ocean awareness. He's recently produced a new documentary on the sharks of San Francisco Bay and has recently worked as cameraman on feature films such as 180 South with Patagonia and A Beautiful Wave. Educated in marine biology, he has a master's in environmental health and has worked in education and public health at the University of California at Berkeley for over a decade. Welcome, David.
Thanks, Rachel. Great to be at the Commonwealth Club.
So I'm going to start right at the beginning. I mean, filmmaking is one thing and wildlife is another. But what for you was the first moment you can remember picking up a camera, encountering some wild animal or wild situation, and what were you thinking in that moment? How did it set you on this path?
Well, I was just reminded at a talk I was giving at the Long Beach Aquarium, I think it was, and I'm really not really a filmmaker. I use film to advocate and change policy and also educate. I'm not a real pedigreed filmmaker like Judy. But I was reminded that I made my first film in junior high school that I'd forgotten on skateboarding. But my first real film was when we were sailing across the Pacific doing coral reef surveys, and it's when I witnessed and experienced the decline of shark species and learned about shark finning and actually filmed it. And we had some cameras on board, and so I started taking all the underwater videography and then boarding the ship, and then that's when I came back and founded Shark Stewards and developed produced a documentary that kind of started the movement about 12, 13 years ago.
That's great. That's great. And Judy, can you remember your first?
I can't remember.
Your first bird?
I'm joking. I've been making films for 4 decades, and birds have always been one of my favorite things to film. So I think that probably in 1985, I could say, I focused the camera for the first time on birds for a film called Treasures of the Greenbelt, which was about Bay Area open space. And I've continued to focus on birds through other short films called Secrets of the Bay and then Dark Circle, the film about the nuclear issue, even had birds in it. I don't know exactly what the connection is, but your atoms do get recycled, and I think maybe I used to be a bird. I don't know. I'm not sure. But it was probably 1985, Treasures of the Greenbelt, yes.
How do you think film is really playing a part in telling stories and conveying these stories about wild animals to audiences?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, way before I became a filmmaker, I tried to be a freelance writer. And I tried to write nonfiction pieces, and I took stills to go with those pieces. But then I went to film school, and I had an awakening. It didn't hurt that film was becoming the thing that people really were interested in and were responding to. But I really, really related to it right from the start and realized that by combining moving images, music, sound effects, and voice, you could tell stories incredibly more strongly than just in writing. You can also afford to be subtle, and you can engage people and get them to love what you love, and then you can ask them to become active. So, I don't know. I think it's absolutely integral to the environmental movement is filmmaking. And you must have discovered that too, mm-hmm. David, right?
Well, film is so powerful on so many levels. And, you know, that pathos and the ethos, and it deeply touches our emotions, and we can connect with moving images more easily than the written word or the still photograph. And it is, especially now with digital films and then the distribution on the web and short media, you can really invoke a huge amount of passion or awareness or just excitement about beauty of the natural world or issues or love. It can come across so powerfully and now so much more easily than before when I actually learned how to splice film like you did. I forgot I learned how to do that because I went right into digital filmmaking after my junior high school skateboard film. So, yeah, I mean, you watch Hollywood has it, right? I was just down in L.A. working on a film project. And, I mean, they have that formula, and that's why movie stars are so famous. We connect with them and their emotions and the issues they're in and the storytellers. And it all comes together with music and drama and crescendo, and it's... there's hardly a better way to express a message to a wide audience.
Mm-hmm. So it is emotional and it is powerful, but how do we convey that, you know, often we're dealing with very tough topics, very hard truths that are out there about environmental degradation and threats to wild species. How do you bring that those tough stories to audiences without really bumming them out about the state of things.
That's a good point. I mean, whenever you focus on a certain animal or a certain topic within the world of wild animals, you immediately find out what the problems are. And often it's mostly what's written about. But for instance, for Pelican Dreams, here is a film that I had loved pelicans since I was a kid, but I didn't know anything about them. And so after Wild Parrots was finished and out there flying into the world, I was able to get back to this movie, which I had started shooting before The Wild Parrots of Telegraph Hill. And it started from love for these birds. Mm-hmm. And very quickly, I found out what a hard time they were having. They had, ironically enough, just been taken off the endangered species list in 2009. But they were hit with a whole series of problems that were related to climate change and habitat destruction and overfishing and your basic everyday fishing line fishhook problems that pelicans get involved with all the time because they hang out in harbors and they hang out near fishing boats. Okay, so how to make a story that's really engaging and that invites people to love pelicans but still gets across these problems? That was my challenge for this movie. And that's pretty much the challenge for every movie that you make about wild animals. They are under attack, you know, primarily by human-caused problems, a lot of it having to do with habitat destruction. And what I did was I found a kind of a neat hook to get people involved in the beginning. This bird landed by mistake on the Golden Gate Bridge and created a huge traffic jam. Nobody ran over the bird. And somebody videotaped it. And you watch the bird being arrested and put into a cop car and take it off. You know, it is a great first sequence. And I followed that bird into care to a wildlife rehabilitation facility and named the bird Gigi after Golden Gate, okay? And so this bird became a character in the film. And then another bird who was living in a backyard in Central California became the other main pelican character. So the idea is that you hook folks in with real characters and real affection. And then later in the movie, like maybe about halfway through, if it's a feature film like this is, then you hit them with the problems. You're not going to avoid the problems, but you're going to put them at the right place. You're going to put them in a place where people want to know. They already have established enough affection for the creature and have learned enough about the animal that they want to know what the problems are. You don't start out with the problems. Is that how you do it too?
I would say that the marine life and such as sharks could be a little more challenging than birds to convey as characters on screen. How do you get around that?
Well, being underwater is definitely one more level of complication, keeping your camera dry and having to breathe and find the animals. I mean, a big challenge is actually trying to find the animals that you're trying to tell the story about. I think I've kind of fallen into stories. I love Judy's films because she's right. I mean, I actually know Judy, to answer your question. I'm really more of an advocate, and so I show the gnarly stuff right up front and turn everybody off. And I've learned not to do that. And you'll see in a film that tonight, a short that we've done in Borneo, where we're working to create shark sanctuaries and stop the shark fin trade, is we're trying to start out with the compelling beauty of the ocean. But I learned the hard way, I think, because not being formally trained and also being impatient, I wanted to get the message across and get people to sign the petition and go down and legislate and advocate, and it turns people off. So what I think are important are human stories, and that gives us our connection to whatever the issues are, because we're anthropocentric. I mean, people work and act in their best interest, no matter how altruistic you are or you think you may be. We still are working for ours and our own, and so trying to appeal to that, but through love or beauty or urgency, just coexisting. But telling people stories, and you have some great characters in your films that I really like. I mean, you get these quirky people, and quirky people are everywhere. I mean, there's a zillion stories. Just walk down the street, and you can tell one. And there's some issue there that can be told in a compelling way through that character's eyes. And so going back to the question, I've learned the hard way. I think I've turned off a lot of people or done sort of the traditional PBS, you know, talking head, we're doomed. What are we going to do? We have to save it now. And you cut to the lower thirds, and it's like that formula broadcasters like, but the audiences don't like as much. You want to see people that you can connect with. And then whatever they're connecting to, hopefully through their eyes and their love, you're going to love it and, in our world, do something about it.
You mentioned advocacy, David. I mean, have you seen in your work that the films you make have been a tool for change? And what does that change look like?
I'd like to think so. Yeah. You know, we were involved with the Ocean Film Festival. Now I'm involved with the Green Film Festival. And films do a lot to reaching an audience that normally you wouldn't be able to reach. The shark fin issue has racial overtones that we had to overcome. But 15 years ago, it was a taboo, and now it's mainstream. We are selecting films, and it's almost hard to find a film that doesn't have shark finning in it, and I kind of want to get away from that. It's like, okay, people are more aware about this atrocity. Now let's deal with the solution or the beauty. So, you know, again, I am an activist, and I use film. I do a lot of public speaking. I talk to zoos or schools or whatever, but I show films because it's boring to have a talking head up there all day just talking. So showing beauty, showing wildlife, showing a short film or what we're doing, because it's really fun. I love to get underwater with a camera. And it's been decades since I've dove without a camera because it just seems boring. I want to do something and I want to document it. And sometimes you'll capture something that's so beautiful or you won't. And sometimes you miss something because you're looking through the viewfinder. But it's just you never know what you're going to get and when you can use it. So I was diving this weekend at Catalina, and we're documenting the marine protected areas that we help support. And I'm out looking for sharks. And are these working to help support sharks and rays? I don't know. We don't know as scientists. So we're diving these MPAs and looking for sharks and filming. And it's a blast. I mean, it's nothing I'd rather do than be underwater with a camera looking for sharks.
Can I ask a question? Sure. What's the most amazing experience you've ever had with a shark underwater?
I've had many. You know, being around any wild animal, that's the beauty of being alive in nature, whether it's a grizzly bear or a parrot or something that connects us to ourselves and the rest of the world. And so looking eye to eye with a great white shark outside of a cage, that is, like this shot I took in Guadalupe. It was right there, perfect focal distance, about 3 feet away. It's really magnificent, and you feel so alive when you're next to something that's so vibrant and so energetic and so consummately adapted to the natural world and has been around for hundreds of millions of years and could munch you in 1 second, but doesn't care, not interested. Just, you know, you're another animal in their world, and they check you out. But one of the most compelling scenes, really, is I've dove with orcas, and it was really one of the most thrilling frightening things because they're so smart. And we were actually filming sharks off the Santa Barbara Channel Islands, and you could hear them and you could feel them in your body. And they're resonating, and they speak in these clicks, and they're communicating. And I knew at first I thought it was bottlenose dolphins, and then it's like it's orcas, and a pack of orcas swam right at us, and it's like a truck going by you with a big brain. And that was pretty thrilling.
Were you frightened?
I mean, definitely. They were so fast, and they just pretty much just kind of lift a fin, and they go by. It's like, well, I could have just taken my head off. Thanks for not doing that. So, yeah, a little bit scared, but mostly just in awe.
This is Ann Clark, and we're at the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is the San Francisco Green Film Festival with Judy Irving, with Wild Parrots of Telegraph Hill and Pelican Dreams, David McGuire, who's a marine biologist, filmmaker, and founder of Shark Stewards, and Rachel Kaplan, CEO, San Francisco Green Film Festival. And back to you, Rachel.
Judy, can I ask you the same question about the most magnificent encounter you've had with a wild animal?
Oh, my.
There must be many. Or David was speaking to the burning need to take a camera with him everywhere he goes. Do you have that need? Are there just moments that you want to capture? We were talking about the pelican character from your film and how you're still following stories of those birds.
Yes, I am still following a story with one of the birds, Moro. Moro is about to get a friend. How many people have seen the pelican movie, Pelican Dreams?
Quite a few.
Okay, in a couple of weeks, we're going to go get a female adult brown pelican as a friend for Moro. And anyway, I'm going to film that whole thing, and I'm going to put it up on Vimeo. And it's going to be the happy ending that I hoped for the movie. I hope. I think that one of the most thrilling things that happened during the Pelican film was that I was out on the Channel Islands where they nest and where they raise chicks. And I really wanted to get footage. I wanted to get a shot of a pelican flying for the first time. What does it feel like to fly for the first time when you are a bird that weighs 8 to 10 pounds and you've spent your entire life on land? And you've been trying out your huge 6-foot wings, but you don't know exactly what they're for yet. What is it like? Is it scary? And so I filmed these birds, these young birds on the Channel Islands, on Santa Barbara Island, flapping and flapping and bouncing around and hopping and practicing, you know. And you could almost just tell that they were excited and scared at the same time. And I was shooting film. I was still shooting film on the Channel Islands. Later, I had to give that habit up. But I had a Bolex camera, which was a wind-up. And it shoots at 64 frames a second. But if you shoot slow motion at 64 frames a second, you only get 8 seconds of real time. And it expands out to 24 seconds or whatever it is when you play it back at 24 frames a second, okay? But I had to start that shot just an instant before the bird took off from land for the first flight. And it was a psychic connection with the bird. I had to know to start filming before it flew, but I only had 8 seconds of flight time in this slow motion film world, okay? And I managed to get 3 birds fledging, and they're all in the movie, so you got to see it. It was thrilling. It was absolutely thrilling. And I handheld it because where are they going to go? If I had kept it on the tripod, I might not have been able to follow them correctly. And when you shoot slow motion, that smooths everything out so you can handhold. But it was scary and exciting for me, too.
So I think we're going to go to a clip now. Judy, let's have a look at a clip from a slightly different change of pace from the Pelican Dreams. Can you tell us what we're going to see in this clip here?
Yes, this clip is from Cormorants and the Crosshairs. It's a short film that I made last summer, and it's an advocacy film. I was outraged to discover that double-crested cormorants were being shot by our government, USDA Wildlife Services, at their nesting site on East Sand Island in the Columbia River. Their nests were being destroyed. Eggs were being oiled to suffocate the chicks. Why? You'll see in this 2-minute intro to the movie. This is the Jetty on the Oregon side of the Columbia River, where the river meets the Pacific Ocean. I was up there trying to get some shots of brown pelicans for my movie Pelican Dreams, but I kept seeing these birds too. They're called double-crested cormorants. They're a seabird, and they nest about 5 miles upriver on East Sand Island. It's the largest known breeding colony of double-crested cormorants in the world. These towers and tunnels were originally built for biologists who were studying the colony. Now they're being used by sharpshooters to kill the birds because the cormorants are eating salmon. The Army Corps of Engineers destroyed salmon habitat upriver by building dams, and now they're required to try to bring the salmon population back up. Cormorants have been eating all kinds of fish for 60 million years, and for these birds, only a small percentage of those fish are salmon. But it's cheaper for the Army Corps to kill the birds than to change the way they operate the dams. That's just the intro to a 10-minute movie, which is up on Vimeo for free. And if you Google cormorants in the crosshairs, you'll find it. There's a lawsuit going to stop the killing. And this is in support of Portland Audubon's lawsuit to stop the killing.
So a very different pace of film there, and a film being used for advocacy. And we've seen this, I think we were talking earlier about films such as Blackfish and Racing Extinction, where films can really be used to like move people around environmental and wildlife issues. And so, David, I had a question for you with your background as a Master in Environmental Health. And really, do you see that there is a benefit of wildlife on human health? And I'd like your take on that too, Judy.
Absolutely. Our human health is intricately connected to the health of wildlife. And we're seeing that. We're seeing the loss of human health or decline in human health because of mercury in seafood or in these organic carbon molecules that are bioaccumulating in our food and a host of other things, from GMO to pesticides. So by not having diversity, we're actually impacting the health of our and the future of humanity.
Judy, do you see a connection?
I also feel that there's a psychic balance that we need. You know, most people now live in cities around the world, and we're becoming more and more cut off from the natural world, but we need it. You know, and so being connected to animals and nature and landscapes and waterscapes and being in those places without mediation, in other words, not looking at your phone, but actually being there, makes a huge difference psychologically, I think. And it creates mental health.
I mean, here in San Francisco, you must observe the way that urban dwellers are engaging with wildlife. What do you see when you go out with your camera?
Well, I went out a few weeks ago to try to film the coyote that's on Telegraph Hill, and I actually saw the animal. It was thrilling because this is a wild creature, looks kind of like a dog, but it's a coyote, and he's making a go of it on Telegraph Hill. The only problem is that people are now feeding him, or maybe only one person is feeding him, but this is not a good thing. He's starting to run up to people, and he's running up to little dogs that are on leashes, you know, and wanting to play with them because some other people with big dogs let their big dogs play with the coyote. So it's that interface between wildlife and people life that we have to be very careful about what we do. because this coyote is going to be put down if it continues like this, because he's going to bite a small dog, or he's going to get himself in trouble somehow because of what people have done. So that's my latest activism thing. I'm going to try to get the person who's feeding him to stop.
Mm. And David, I know that both of you are no strangers to, as well as being in the city, being like in the bay and under the water and showing us what's out there. David, can you tell us a little bit about the animals of the bay in relation to our urban environment?
Well, Judy said it well, and actually, yeah. I love Judy's stories about the human-wildlife interface, which mm-hmm. we're fortunate enough, living here in the Bay Area, to have quite a bit with our open space of the GGNRA, the San Francisco Bay, the ocean. We have a lot of wildlife. We're very fortunate. But both Judy and I swim in the Bay. We both belong to adjoining clubs, the Dolphin Club and the South End. We're both open water swimmers. I swim passages, I guess, to islands and that kind of thing. And you encounter a lot of wildlife. And I did a little film called Swim for Sharks, and it was interviewing some of the old-timers of the club, which is just amazing history that they have. But also the point of the film was it's not the sharks we should be afraid of. Somebody got bit by a grebe. There was one year where sea lions with domoic acid poisoning bit about 17 swimmers, and this is happening again this year. So we have this interaction with wildlife, and then you get a lot more of it when you're in the bay. And there was a white shark that preyed on a seal, much to the excitement of the fifth graders who are watching it and the millions of people on YouTube who saw it, and a lot of the swimmers who did the Alcatraz swim a few days later. But there has not been a white shark attack on a person in the San Francisco Bay. But it's, you know, they're there, and it's exciting to me. So I feel we're very fortunate to get in the water, and I seek wild places. And one of my early mistakes in my photography, and I'm a writer, is that I avoid people. I love animals and I love wildness, and I've sought wildness, and I've also seen wildness diminish. So I go to the ends of the earth, and one of those ends of the earth are the Farallon Islands right out here in the Gulf of the Farallon South Marine Sanctuary, which is still a very extremely wild place, and there are double-crested cormorants out there, and they're in breeding mm-hmm. plumage, and you know, one of the largest rookeries in North America, and also has great white sharks. So we're very fortunate to have that, and there are all those interactions that we can have if we choose.
So shall we take a look under the waves? We have a clip. Can you tell us what we'll see in this clip?
Sure. So I'm working increasingly in Borneo and Southeast Asia, and primarily because we've had a lot of success in America on the shark fin trade. We've reduced it probably 50 to 70% because of awareness and legislation, making it illegal to sell shark fin soup. So there's a lot of awareness around it. Now we're going back to where it's the mass consumption is, but also areas that we can help protect. And we're trying to protect areas that are, again, driven by economic incentive, humans' first interest, and that's a livelihood. And so we're working with ecotourists to help protect the ecosystem so that the tourists will keep coming and hire the natives, people as boat drivers or guides or scuba tank instructors or whatever it is, so they'll have a job that will perpetuate and they won't just kill the shark for $100 and that's gone forever, or they'll consume their whole ecosystem. So this is a series, which is actually, this was the first short of launching a campaign then called the Semporna Shark Sanctuary. Now it's creating several shark sanctuaries in Sabah, Borneo, and protecting the entire ecosystems. This is more of an advocacy piece. You'll see, you know, the drama. But now we're doing this series called Borneo from Below that is an online series, and we call it Funservation. And it's kind of silly, but it has a message. And many of these are also translated into Chinese or into Malay or into some of the countries that we're screening them in and trying to influence the people with local people in the films. So this was sort of the first blush, which has reached success. The Minister of the Environment has said that he will gazette 3 shark sanctuaries, the first ones in the entire region. Mm. Thank you.
Sharks. These majestic and graceful creatures have roamed the oceans for more than 400 million years. The 83 islands and reefs making up the Sampurna region are located on the east coast of Malaysian Borneo. As part of the Coral Triangle, this region is a global hotspot for marine biodiversity. This environment supports a delicately balanced ecosystem, of which sharks are an absolutely vital part. This region boasts 68 species of ray and 63 species of shark, including the gigantic whale shark and thresher shark. However, this marine ecosystem is under attack. Sharks are being caught and finned in large numbers. This relentless and wasteful fishing is unsustainable. It is estimated that worldwide up to 73 million sharks are finned every year. This is to supply the demand for the Chinese delicacy of shark fin soup. The irony is, the fin has zero nutritional value to consumers. In fact, consuming fins has been directly linked with mercury poisoning and Alzheimer's disease.
So many beautiful sharks there in that film. I mean, filming sharks, it's not for everyone. How did you get into that? Can you remember your first shark encounter? And
I do. I'm writing a book about it right now called Surfing and Sharks. And it was right around the period of Jaws, which had a major impact on our psyche. And there are still people who are terrified of sharks, including kids whose parents weren't old enough to see sharks. I mean, it's a 40-year-old film, very compelling, very powerful, but it did a lot of disservice. And Peter Benchley, who I got to know, and he produced several documentaries and wrote several books, trying to undo what the book and especially the film did. So these images really have, obviously, a huge impact, both in negative and positive ways. So when I was out surfing and I saw a shark and I thought it was so cool and I paddled towards it when people were kind of freaking out, and not even surfing, it was great. The water was wide open. In many cases, we want more sharks, I think, if you're a surfer, because you can get more waves. But what really got me into filming sharks was we were doing an expedition across the Pacific filming coral reefs, and we were in the Tuamotu Archipelago, which is part of French Polynesia, and we were diving these atolls. And some of them we would splash, and you'd see 100 sharks. It's like, wow, they're everywhere. This is crazy. And then we were diving similar islands that had no sharks. And we asked the question, what's going on here? And we learned it was driven largely for the shark fin trade. The tuna fishermen were getting money just for the fins, not for the bodies. And that's when I did the documentary Shark Stewards of the Reef and realized how large the problem really is. I mean, what this film shows for me, this is sort of the old school of films that I've done. This is with a group called Scuba Zoo, who's done a lot of work with David Attenborough and Blue Planet series. Just amazing cinematography and more beauty. So we're trying to merge that beauty with conservation and advocacy, but again, more human stories. So the Borneo from below is more human wonder, but you see what we're doing through other human experiences or just direct observation. So that shark finning scene I've shown to thousands of kids. And it works in some ways, but many ways those negative images are gruesome and turn people off. And I'd like to convey that sharks are beautiful and important in other ways, aside from the bloody scene of a shark being finned.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is the San Francisco Green Film Festival. And we've come to that point in our program, with Judy Irving, Wild Parrots of Telegraph Hill and Pelican Dreams, and David McGuire, marine biologist, filmmaker, and founder of Shark Stewards, and Rachel Kaplan, who's the CEO of San Francisco Green Film Festival. We've come to that time for our audience questions, and we will use the mic for the audience. So do we have a question out in the audience yet? Here we are.
I had a quick question for David. It has to do with the threat of trash. I've read stuff about plastics and a terrible amount of human waste going into the ocean. Is that overwrought in the media, or is that something that you're actively thinking about?
We're actively thinking about it, and it's not overplayed. I think there's a film in the festival about it, about plastics, and there have been several in past Green Film Festivals. We are hearing a lot about it, the Great Pacific Gyre, the Garbage Patch. We've been working on a cigarette butt campaign here in San Francisco. 3 billion cigarette butts hit the streets in the Bay Area, and those are plastic. They take 15 years to degrade. So we created a local stewardship program, and hopefully you'll see it on buses and benches and trying to educate smokers that that's plastic going into the food chain. It's a huge problem, particularly in Asia. You can walk across the single-use water bottles. We're doing a better job here, but we started it. You know, I mean, we're the major consumers. We basically created plastic, and we're living with it, and we're going to be living with it forever. And it's not just at the surface. It never goes away. It just breaks down into smaller molecules that end up assimilated so that some 30% or more of plankton, the smallest animals and plants in the ocean that the largest animals need to survive for their food that we rely on for 70% of our oxygen, are integrating this plastic and these contaminants into their bodies and into the food chain. So it is very of a severe crisis. The single-use plastic, I mean, San Francisco is, again, the icon city, plastic bag bans, plastic bottle bans. I mean, we're raising a lot of awareness here. It needs to go worldwide, but it's a serious issue. Thank you. Good question.
Are you seeing it impacting wildlife when you're here in the city, when you're swimming in the bay?
Well, I dissected a dead leopard shark, and it had a cigarette butt and other plastic in its gut. But we see birds with the monofilaments, really a big problem. Fishermen discard their lines. It gets wrapped up, and it hurts the birds. Or you still see the plastic six-pack rings around necks of seals. And, yeah, we see it here in the bay.
My question is for both of you, but I think I got a partial answer from what you were talking about with cormorants when you were doing the pelicans and were redirected. So do you generally have an idea of where the storyline is going, or do you allow the filming and the animals to take you on that journey of storytelling?
I definitely let the reality tell me how to create the movie. It's different with fiction films where you write a script and you've got dialogue and then you go out and film the script and you basically edit pretty much the same thing as the script. With a documentary, you're allowed to basically go out and do research with your camera. And reality tells you what's what. You don't know beforehand what you're going to get. Like you were saying, you don't know what you're going to get when you go down under the water with your camera. I often go out looking for one thing, and I don't get it. And I get something else that I hadn't expected. So, yes, it definitely, the just being out there, spending time, and keeping the faith, and having a lot of patience, and being willing to spend 6 years on a movie, each one of these films took over 5 years, that's where you get the stuff that actually starts to hold together as a story. But it isn't easy, but it's really fun.
I mean, you bring up the point, Judy, about reality. And I was wondering, because we hear that very often, or sometimes, rather, in wildlife filmmaking, things are very scripted, in fact, can be very, very staged at the service of the message or the service of the story. And I was just be curious to hear from both of you how important you think it is to convey, like, the truth of the situation, as opposed to, I mean, I think you answered it in that last answer, Judy, but David, do you have thoughts on that? You must encounter it.
Well, it depends on who's paying you.
Oh, that's interesting.
Having worked in Hollywood and just helping, we're doing a film called The Big Swim, and it's a drama, so it is scripted. Mm-hmm. It has actors, it has a budget, and it's like, come on, people, move, move, move. We've got to get this, got to get this. You have a director, and the sharks aren't cooperating. Get the shark over there with the actress. The shark doesn't want to go there. And it's a bull shark. I don't think I want to convince it. And so it's difficult in that respect. But, you know, when you're doing it independent, you can tell your own story. And like Judy said, you get this shot. It's like, oh, my God, that was amazing. Or not getting the shot also tells the story. In the case of wildlife, it's like we've been sitting here for 7 days and we haven't seen it. And, you know, I helped a little bit with some BBC work and National Geographic, and that's the big budget. And sometimes the snow leopard shot, for example, on planet Earth, where they sat in the cave for like 3 months and froze and ate ramen until he finally got the shot. I mean, that takes a tremendous amount of patience to get that one shot. And I don't have that. So it's sort of a mix. But if you're doing an independent film, you can change it. You can go back, hopefully, or you can let the film or the story evolve a lot more. And to me, that's a lot more fun than a high production scripted project.
Interesting. More questions,
please. We have one more question.
Hi, this question is for both Judy and David. So each of the efficacy efforts that you have put in, whether it's on birds or on sharks, takes a tremendous amount of effort and dedication and patience. So I'm wondering, how do you keep going when the response that you're trying to elicit doesn't quite, you know, it's not quite what you're expecting, and how do you keep going and, you know, before funding runs out?
Well, first of all, there's almost never enough funding. So that's just a constant problem. I've never waited to have a full budget to start a movie. If I did that, I wouldn't have made any films in the past 40 years. So you get a little bit of funding and you start work. How do you keep going? I think it's just this passionate interest. And also, in the case of the cormorants, it's outrage. I'm outraged that our tax dollars are being spent to kill birds by the organization, by our government organization, the Army Corps of Engineers, that has caused the problem in the first place by destroying salmon habitat upriver. So that keeps me going. But, okay, certain people have said, well, they're not going to win their lawsuit because the judge is in bed with the, you know, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and with the Army Corps of Engineers. It's all federal. It's a federal judge. It's federal agencies. They don't go against each other. I hope that's not true. If that happens, that the Audubon Society loses its lawsuit, there's probably going to be some people who do civil disobedience up there who try to get in between the shooters and the cormorants. The feeling is that strong. And so, you know, you engage and you're interested. And do you light one candle or do you curse the darkness? You know, I don't know. You got to light the one candle.
Unfortunately, we've come to that point in the program for our last question, and I'm going to ask that. Oops, we have someone in the audience who wants to ask that. Just one moment, and we'll get right to her.
Thank you. Solutions to these issues, these terrible issues that are happening in our environment constantly and in more and more all the time, but solutions can be incredibly complex and affect so many different aspects of the way that we live and the way that our society operates. How deeply do you feel you can go in films to address the alternate solutions that are available and all the viewpoints that are available to these?
I don't think you have to tell all the story unbiased. You know, we're not news reporters. So that's part of what an advocacy or a documentary film is about, is we want to tell our point of view. I mean, hopefully you're going to tell it fairly, but I'm not going to give a shark finner equal time, even if it's a poor subsistence fisherman. I want to tell the issue in as balanced or at least a rational way. But, I mean, to answer your question, really, we have the greatest tools now ever to reach a mass audience and influence people. And using social media, using short film, using large productions, it's fathomless. So we have more tools than anybody ever had at a time that is more human crisis, more devastation of wildlife. So we're at really the tipping point is we have this urgency. 50% of coral reefs are gone, but 50% are left. And I think that we have the tools that we can address the issue. And you can let the eggheads and the politicians argue the details, but you have to get it on their plate. And so we've introduced a lot of legislation that never would have been introduced without passion, without advocacy, without people taking a day off their job and going and telling their lawmakers that they want to change now. And you're seeing that. You saw it in Paris. I mean, yeah, they're big issues. It's difficult. It's a challenge. But Yvon Chouinard of Patagonia is a great mentor of mine, and he just said, you have to do something. To do good, you have to do something. And that's what I tell kids. They're the great hope, and they're also the great inheritors of what we're leaving them. And I apologize to them, but they're also the solution. And I pretty much say, you know, do something. To do good, you got to do something, no matter what it is. Piece of plastic, pick it up, whatever. Do something.
Would you like to make a comment? I have one question, so let me go ahead with it. And it combines two things, and I'd like for both of you to respond. One would be your comments now about where we are with the coral reefs, and one where you think we are now and where we're going with this issue of plastic. So those are kind of tough questions, and I would love to hear what you have to say about them in terms of advocacy.
I'm not an expert on either one of those, so I'm going to turn it over to David.
Well, we all have an influence in our daily lives, and we're aware about climate change and ocean acidification, so driving less or reducing. Half the coral reefs are either threatened or gone, but with 50% left in areas like we're trying to protect in the Coral Triangle has 25% of all species in the ocean. So looking at the areas that are the most important to protect and protect them now, because it's harder to restore than it is to protect. So we're seeing that. We're paying millions of dollars in these restoration efforts. It was a lot easier to put some awareness, some science, some education, and protect it. So we know that in America we've got about 10% of our land protected and probably more marine protected areas than anywhere else in the world. Other countries don't have that benefit. So educating people in emerging nations is essential. And that the plastic issue is a really big one. Overfishing and plastics are major short-term impacts that we can change. Acidification we're going to be living with for 500 years or 1,000 years, and we've got to reverse that now through these policy things that are gigantic, almost insurmountable for activists or local people. But collectively, we've made huge impacts and changes in the world, and I know that we can in the future as well.
That's all we have time for this evening. I'd like to extend a warm thank you to our guests. To continue the conversation, I invite you to join us at the 2016 Green Film Festival, running April 14th through 20th, for 70 new films with over 90 guest speakers in San Francisco and Berkeley. In particular, on April 17th, you can continue the conversation with Judy. We have the event Parrots, Pelicans, and People, Oh My, where Judy will be offering a look into the lives of local creatures, humans included, as we struggle to survive in urban and wild environments. The program's going to include clips from even more of her films and a deeper discussion on Judy's creative process. So a huge thank you to our guests this evening, Judy Irving and David McGuire. And to you, the audience, thank you for doing your part to keep it wild.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is the San Francisco Green Film Festival. Many thanks from me also to our excellent panel. And I really want to thank Rachel Kaplan for being with us tonight and talking to us about the Green Film Festival that is coming up. And also the club's thanks to Judy Irving for Wild Parrots of Telegraph Hill and Pelican Dreams, and David McGuire, marine biologist, filmmaker, and founder of Sharks. And from us at the Commonwealth Club, many, many thanks to our wonderful audience here and on the radio and the Internet. You can find our programs on the Internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. Click on commonwealthclub.org also for multimedia access to programs, current news feeds, streaming audio, radio schedules, and 230 radio stations on national radio networks. Also find audio and videotapes and free weekly podcasts and archived programs. We hope you will come back to the Commonwealth soon and look for our upcoming environmental programs. On Monday, March 28th, we'll have a conversation about Atul Godani's book, Being Mortal, which is a program which will be next Monday, and we hope you will join us on that. On Tuesday, April 19th, Airport Director John Martin speaks about our San Francisco International Airport's commitment to the environment and sustainability. Under John Martin's leadership, the San Francisco International Airport has become a model worldwide for environmental and sustainable work. On Wednesday, April 27th, our April update on the El Nino effect, California water, snowpack, and drought. A panel of experts will discuss where we're at the end of April and what the summer might hold. And on Thursday, May 12th, we'll look at the environment from a slightly different viewpoint than we often do, and that will be with Claire Brown, professor of the Graduate School of Economics, UC Berkeley, and she will talk about the necessity of creating quality of life for a sustainable global environment. And finally, I'm going to turn it back over to Rachel and have each of Rachel and then each of our panel members tonight, Judy and David, say one last thing that they would like to say before we officially end the program. Rachel?
I think everyone can make a difference. You just have to find out what that one environmental passion is and then hook onto it and hold on tight.
And I would encourage you to make a movie about your favorite animal.
Yeah.
And put it online. It can be short. But just follow your heart.
Can it be on Facebook? Judy is nodding her head. Yes, it can go on Facebook. David?
What is it? Be the wild?
Keep it wild.
Keep it wild.
Keep it wild.
Keep it wild. What could be better than that? And, you know, I like what Judy said. Be passionate. Be passionate about something good and do something. Rachel founded the Green Film Festival, and we've worked together for over a decade. And to see what she's done with this festival is just extraordinary. So help it out. Show some films. Share it. Share it on social media. Come watch it. And there's so many great stories and great filmmakers. I'm very excited to participate. Thanks Rachel,
thanks
for setting
everyone.
This up.
Thank
too.
You. Thank Good you. Filmmakers. Thank you.
And I will second and third that. Rachel has done an enormous job starting all of this, and now we have such a successful program about green film in the spring, and it's really a wonderful, wonderful event. So let me say that we are very happy that you all came, and we hope you will come back. This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. This forum was also co-sponsored by Business and Leadership Member-Led Forum with Kevin O'Malley, the chair. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you.